This is the fourth and final lesson that I'll be giving on what I've called Lostology. And just in review, two weeks ago in the evening, the third lesson that I gave were these. Law number 13 was, a search reveals your values. Number 14, a search is always costly. Number 15, a search requires whatever love will pay. Number 16, a search becomes your consuming priority. 17, a search is always lost-centered, not searcher-centered. And then finally we looked at 2 weeks ago, a search is urgent because the lost are in danger. Now these 24 laws are divided up into four parts. And I've been giving six laws in each one. First was the thinking of the lost. We need to understand how the lost think. Number two was the condition of the lost. Number three, the cost of the lost. That's what we looked at 2 weeks ago. Just what is involved on our part as far as the cost is involved. And tonight, we'll be looking at the search for the lost. So law number 19 is this. Searchers need coordination. In Luke chapter 10, I believe Jesus revealed some of this coordination that is necessary in reaching the lost, in the church in particular, reaching the lost. There in the first two verses, Luke wrote this. After these things, the Lord appointed 70 others also and sent them two by two before his face into every city and place where he himself was about to go. Then he said to them, the harvest truly is great, but the laborers are few. Therefore pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. As Lord, I know that Jesus could have done anything on the earth that he wanted to do. But the fact is, when he did come down here and live on the earth, he limited himself as a human. He did the things that we did. And with the exception of miracles, there were things he couldn't do. I mean, he needed to sleep at night. He needed to eat, and so on. And so he limited himself to some degree. But my point is this. Jesus as a man could not personally teach every person on the earth. So he gathered 12 men whom he trained, and here in Luke 10 it even adds 70 that he had been training. And he sent them out. In Luke 10, you also notice that these 70 are going to be doing something that really all succeeding generations are doing. They're teaming up with people. They're not necessarily going solo. Now, sometimes you are going to be by yourself. But they're teaming up in order to teach others. And Jesus wouldn't be here forever. The apostles and the 70 wouldn't be here forever. And we're not going to be here forever. So we need to show others whatever it is we know. And not just in matters of evangelism. If you teach a class here at the building, find someone that you can show how to do that. If you're someone who likes to show hospitality and have people into your home, as simple as that might sound to you, it's not necessarily to someone who doesn't do that. If you see someone who has an interest in that, show them, teach them. In verse 2 of Luke 10, Jesus revealed the key factor in getting more laborers for the vast harvest. And that is to pray, he said, the Lord of the harvest, that he send out more laborers into his harvest. Now, he knows that it's his harvest. But he wants, He wants us, or he wants to see if we know that it's his harvest, and we can show that by praying to him that he send out laborers into his harvest. And you know, I've been praying this passage and a companion one in Matthew 9:36 for decades. And I have seen it fulfilled in various ways. And I believe it's going to be fulfilled again with this Fishers of Men class. I believe that's an answer to my prayer. I've never said that to anyone, but I've been praying it for a long time. Before I ever came here, before I was even in Long Beach. Klamath Falls, I was praying it in Long Beach. And I've seen so many times how the Lord has fulfilled that prayer. So, pray as he said to do there in Luke 10. Law number 20. Searchers do not need discouragement. If someone is searching, they don't need us to discourage them. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul is dealing with the subject of the resurrection. But what he says in the last verse, I think, applies to any good work that we're involved in, such as evangelizing. Here he said, "Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as you know that your work is not in vain in the Lord." Why did he tell the Corinthians that? Well, they may have been discouraged or on the verge of discouragement, so he had to let them know, don't give up. I want to encourage you to keep pressing on in whatever good works you're doing, because it's not in vain. So don't be like the 10 spies who discouraged the hearts of the children of Israel. Don't discourage someone if you see them evangelizing and tell them, well, that really can't be done. Don't tell them that the world's a lost cause. Give them support. Tell him that you're praying for him. And don't just say, I'm praying for you. Say, I'm praying for you, you know, for example, that you would be bold or that you'd be meek and humble, that you'll have the answers when people ask you questions or whatever it is. And then you might even say, are there any things that you want me to pray for in your behalf? Support them morally, support them financially, support them with material or resources or whatever it might be. This is one of the reasons why the book of 3 John is in the Bible. Gaius, the recipient of 3 John, would receive preachers evidently and send them on their way. But look what John says in verses 5 through 8 of 3 John. Beloved, you do faithfully whatever you do for the church and for strangers who have borne witness of your love before the church. If you send them forward on their journey in a manner worthy of God, you will do well. Because they went forth for his namesake, taking nothing from the Gentiles. In other words, the church, or in this case perhaps preachers who were coming to his home, cannot expect the world to support the work of the church. It's the church that's supposed to support its own works. Verse 8. We therefore ought to receive such that we may become fellow workers for the truth. Also, let us remember Numbers chapter 32. This is about when 2.5 tribes had decided they wanted to remain on the east side of the Jordan. And when Moses heard that, he was angry. Because he thought, okay, we're going to stay over here where we've been for 40 years, and then the brethren can go into the land of Canaan and fight and all that stuff. And of course, they would explain to him later, oh no, we not only will we go to war, but we'll lead in the warfare. But even if what they were doing, let's assume that what they were doing was wrong, listen to what Moses said in verse 7. Now, why will you discourage the heart of the children of Israel from going over into the land which the Lord has given them? Why are you trying to discourage your brethren? He was rebuking them for something that he thought they were doing wrong. We don't want to be guilty of discouraging our brethren. Or remember Judges chapter 8, when the men of Succoth told Gideon that they would not help him in his fight against the Midianites, but he promised them that when he came back, that he would deal with them accordingly, and he did. He destroyed their city. Law number 21. Searchers sometimes need to wait. And you know, that goes against the grain. You know, like in search and rescue, you don't join search and rescue and then go to a location where a search needs to be made and wait. But sometimes that has to happen. In Luke chapter 15, from which I've drawn much of my material, you'll see that sort of thing happening. You know, in the first parable in that chapter, Jesus spoke about a shepherd who went searching for his lost sheep. Then after that, he gave another parable talking about a woman who went to go look for her lost coin. But then in the third parable, a father loses his son. But the father does not go looking for the son. Instead, he waits for his son to come back home. So in verse 20, Jesus said this about the son, and he arose and came to his father. But when he was still a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion, and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. The son didn't need to knock on the door before his father knew he was there. The father was waiting expectantly for his son. Evidently, I would guess, looking every day and every chance he got during the day. He's looking off in the distance, probably in the direction that his son had left in. And then when he saw his son a long ways off, he runs out there to get him. He could tell by his body language that his son was brokenhearted and down and out. So the father in this story simply had to wait for his son to return. There was nothing more he could do. He had done everything that a father could do. But the son had decided that he wanted to go live a worldly life. And really, probably for the father to have done anything more would have irritated his son and driven him away. And the son, perhaps he knew, would find out the harsh realities of the world soon enough. So he couldn't go out and go searching in this case, but just had to wait. But when he saw his son and his son was coming home, he received him joyfully. Likewise, people need to have memories of the love of God and the love of the church, especially of their home church, their home congregation. But in too many cities, their memories are only of a harsh, backbiting church. If someone were to return, or if someone's a new convert, would they go to me? We all need to ask ourselves. Believing that I have an accepting spirit, like the father in the story, or would they stay away from me, believing that I had a rejecting spirit, like the Pharisees, against whom Jesus had directed this parable? How do I treat my fellow Christians now? How do I react when someone does return or when someone responds to the invitation? Number 22. Searchers don't always have joy. Sometimes you can put so much into a church and it's just not a happy ending. I mean, you know, literally like in search and rescue situations, sometimes the person's died. They're gone forever. And sometimes that happens spiritually too. And I think Paul expressed his sadness in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 when he expressed to us how he felt when someone was stumbling or falling. In verse 29, he said this, "Who is weak? And I am not weak. Who is made to stumble? And I do not burn with indignation." Paul was troubled when someone fell away from Christ. And I think he was troubled when people weren't even to Christ in the first place. And you know, Jesus didn't save everyone during his ministry. In fact, he even lost one of his precious 12. We may do everything perfectly as Jesus did, and still some will not be saved. In fact, the Bible even indicates that most will not be saved. Now, if you've been trying to convert someone, and if you have failed, then repent. You know, if there's something you've done wrong, you know, change it. Do differently or whatever it is you need to do. But don't assume that you have failed if someone wasn't saved. The lost have to bear the responsibility for their own souls when they have to stand before God. Sometimes I hear people say, well, everyone can be reached. But if that's the case, did Jesus not know the way to save Judas? Did he not know the way to save his enemies, the Pharisees? True, some Christians can reach some people that other Christians could not. And some people are reached by one method and they're not reached by another. But it's also true that some people just don't want to be saved. They enjoy a life of sin. Remember the very first law? The very first law was being lost can be fun. Some people just don't want to give up their fun, and they won't till the day they die. They look at Christianity as boring and their lives as exciting, and hey, why should they change? Some people see the truth and they acknowledge it as the truth, but they're just stubborn and they don't want to change. And all kinds of things like that. So the failure is not on our part. And I'm not saying we never make mistakes. But sometimes searches just don't end the way we'd like them to end. Number 23. Searchers are sometimes themselves found. Well, like in the case of the parable of the prodigal son. The father wasn't out searching. The son found his father again. Do you remember I told you I was reading that book about the man who was hiking in Utah and got stuck literally between a rock and a hard place, and he was there for 6 days and he eventually cut his arm off? Well, there were people out searching for him finally, but he found them once he got out. He found his searchers. The rich young ruler found Jesus. Nicodemus went to Jesus. In fact, when you look at the gospel accounts, most people went to Jesus rather than him going to them. Because once he had established his reputation as the kind of the man he was, they all just started flocking to him. And that's my story. The church didn't find me. But rather, already in my mind, long before I ever had connection with the church, I had started doing some thinking. In the last couple of months of my high school, it was like I suddenly woke up. Hey, dude, you're about ready to graduate from high school. What are you going to do? You know, I just goofed off for 4 years. I made no plans for college. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And all of a sudden, it's kind of like I dropped all my old friends, started making new friends, and it was all the ones who were serious. Maybe we would even call them nerds today. And I saw myself changing. I moved to Colorado and eventually got connected with the church there. But there were some people early in my life that maybe they did have an influence on me and I didn't realize it. For example, the elementary school that I attended in Pasadena, California, Alexander Hamilton Elementary. So this would have been during the mid-60s. I remember that these ladies would come to our school and the school would let out students who wanted to go, and we would go into their bus or trailer or something off the school grounds, and they would teach us Bible lessons. And I loved that. I don't know who they were or what church they were from or anything about them. I wish I knew. But did they plant some seeds that when I was 17, it started to click again? And then finally when I was 18, I obeyed the gospel. But here's my point about this law. The lost find those who are doing the searching. The lost are not going to go to the people who are not interested in the lost. For example, people during the days of Jesus went to him and not to the Pharisees, because the Pharisees weren't interested in those people. Jesus was, and they knew it. Finally now, number 24. The 24th law of Lostology. Searchers should celebrate. When someone is finally saved, man, that's the time to celebrate. And again, I take you to Luke chapter 15. In the first two parables that Jesus gave, after that lost sheep was found, a lost coin was found, and he explained how the shepherd and the woman celebrated with their friends, Jesus then said this in verse 10. Likewise, I say to you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. That blew my mind when somebody told me that after I became a Christian. Someone said, Don, did you know that the angels in heaven celebrated when you were converted? I said, no. And they showed me this passage. What? I was thrilled at that. You mean the angels in heaven knew what I did on November 2nd, 1976? They were thrilled. And so I would encourage you, when someone is converted to Christ, celebrate with that person. When someone's baptized into Christ, celebrate. Because when you celebrate with that person, you're celebrating with the angels. And how would you like to attend a party of angels celebrating someone who's been saved? Well, that's what you're doing when you're rejoicing over someone who has been baptized. And yet it can be very disheartening when someone is baptized, but few people will greet that person or celebrate with them. Over how many things does the Bible say angels rejoice? And if the Bible says that angels rejoice over something we do on the earth, should we not celebrate as much? What are we doing that is so important that we can't congratulate a new brother or sister in Christ who has been saved from the fires of hell? And that's something to rejoice over. So I'd encourage you to take the time to welcome a new Christian, especially if you're the one who's involved in the conversion process. But even if not, greet that person. Congratulate them. You will make a huge impression upon him, perhaps preventing him from falling away later when some struggle comes up in his or her life. And thereby you will be helping the church to grow. Let me just try to sum up all of these 24 laws. With each one, with each lesson, I should say, I've been introducing that in order to save the lost, we have to understand the laws. But let me also say this. Love people, and you will do the right thing. I know sometimes we think that I don't know what to say, I don't know what to do, whatever. Just love people, and you will do the right thing. Be considerate of people, and you will not do the wrong thing. Is that oversimplification? I really don't think so. Just love and be considerate. You'll do the right thing, and you won't do the wrong thing. And if you need help, well, ask the Lord. And ask someone in the church. There's people who are always ready to help, who can give advice or something. Now, if you're here tonight with another burden on your heart that has nothing to do with evangelism, and you're just thinking, I just need prayers for such and such. If you find yourself in that situation tonight, don't leave here tonight either without asking someone in private for prayers, or if you need to, you know, you can ask the whole church. And when we stand and sing, you can come forward and let that be known. You can do that now.